How would you describe open innovation?
Allowing the rest of the world to work on your problem. Opening up your problem in a way so the rest of the world works in your problem. And what we find in our research is that open innovation is often cheaper, faster, and better than what you can do yourself.
Welcome to Canada Insights. I'm your host, Sahil Badruddin, and today we have with us Dr. Karim Lakhani, an expert on open innovation and a professor at Harvard Business School. Thank you for giving us this interview.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So as the principal investigator of the Crowd Innovation Lab and the NASA Tournament Lab at Harvard, you live and breathe open innovation. Can you explain exactly what is open innovation? Why is it important, its benefits, and why forward-looking organizations and institutions are increasingly adopting it?
Sure, yes. So I've been thinking about this problem since probably 1995, so close to now pushing 23 years. And I first came around this problem when I, finished my undergrad and was starting to, was working at General Electric. And what I discovered was that our customers were not following our marketing message. So there used to be these GE commercials that say, we bring good things to life. Meaning that GE would be the one innovating and coming up with the brilliant ideas and then bringing them to customers. But when I was visiting customers in the healthcare sector, they were actually out innovating us. Mm-hmm. They were often ahead of our engineering schedule and were solving real problems that you would later learn from and figure out how to create products around. And that was a puzzle because it didn't fit the sort of the standard economic model of companies that are manufacturers innovating and consumers consuming. And then I really saw this a lot in the world of software where Linux and open source software was emerging. So when I went to MIT for my graduate studies, after I'd worked for about 4 years at GE, I ran across a professor by sheer accident who had sort of done a lot of work showing that, in fact, users often innovated ahead of manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And he had focused a lot on sort of singleton users working on their own, solving a very important problem. And I'd seen in open source that, in fact, communities of people were sharing knowledge and working together and doing the same thing what he had seen, but at a much larger scale and scope. And so, as luck would have it, I ended up doing my master's thesis with him, and then I also did my PhD research with him as well. And that really got me into the track to try to understand this phenomenon of open innovation. And the basic model to think about is that, and we sort of use what's known as Joy's Law. Bill Joy has coined this law, which says no matter who you are, most of the smartest people work for someone else.
Right.
And Bill Joy, was a co-founder of Sun Microsystems, a real really great computer scientist, And this observation was from him looking at Silicon Valley and seeing that often for any one problem that he might be trying to solve at Sun, there'd be lots of people outside of Sun that might be actually more effective potentially than folks inside of Sun.
Exactly.
And so this notion that, that there are more smart people outside of your organization, outside of your team than are inside of your team that could potentially help you, sort of motivates and animates a lot of open innovation. Mm. And the other thing is that we also know that knowledge, people often think of knowledge as being free-flowing, but again, some of the work my advisor has done, Eric Von Nippel, has shown that knowledge is actually pretty sticky. It's a sticky problem. It is hard to move knowledge from place to place. And so the locus of innovation shifts to where knowledge is the most stickiest. So those two sort of concepts and this empirical observation of my customers out innovating GE, seeing the rise of open source, got me to start doing research in this area. And I've done a lot of work on both open source software communities and how they work, as well as the rise of crowdsourcing contests to solve pretty tough problems. I've worked with folks at NASA. We have a pretty large scale, now an 8-year relationship with NASA, where we take some of their toughest computational engineering science challenges and we run them as contests so people from around the world can help solve them. We've done similar things at Harvard Medical School with various colleagues in different departments to private sector as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we first started down this road, people were like highly skeptical, like, you know, this can't be true. How could it be the case? But we've built both, you know, empirical evidence for this, but also my lab actually, you know, not only does social science research, but we actually get involved in framing the problems, running these contests, and creating solutions that are then used by our partners. And so now we've built a body of work, and also there's now just so many more examples of this happening around the world, from Wikipedia to open source to, you know, General Electric or to Siemens, to Google and Facebook, right? All, you know, leading companies now have an open innovation model at the heart of what they're doing.
If you were to explain it to a layman or to explain it in a nutshell, how would you describe open innovation? What would you tell them it is? And
oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, the thing about open innovation is allowing the rest of the world to work on your problem. Opening up your problem in a way so the rest of the world works in a problem. And what we find in our research is that open innovation is often cheaper, faster, and better than what you can do yourself.
And so what are some real worldwide examples that have really been successful in opening it up and using this?
Android and actually iOS are also based on open innovation. Then some of the work we've done in the medical school setting, what we have shown, like, for example, in computational biology and genome sequencing, you know, our crowds do better than the scientists at Harvard and MIT, right? Mm-hmm. And they often do things that are very different than what Harvard and MIT scientists have done. Our crowd is better than what NASA can do internally themselves. We've done, you know, head-to-head competitions with large pharma companies and their R&D organizations with random crowd members in our competing and also coming up with amazing solutions. And so, you know, those are some you know, sort of very, we're going to have a very tough, very tough sort of intellectual challenges. But then there's some fun ones, right? For example, Doritos has been running these Crash the Super Bowl commercials, and those are user-generated commercials that get, it's a contest, people compete to create those commercials, people vote on them and put them together and do amazing things. All the way to, like, you know, my favorite t-shirt company is Threadless, which is in Chicago, and it's a completely distributed model where people submit t-shirt designs, people critique t-shirt designs, people improve on those t-shirt designs, then people vote, and then the best performing t-shirts get made by this company. The winners get to keep money from that, from the sales, and it's a fully distributed model of this
automated
work. So across the board, from content creation to, you know, to fashion, to consumer products, to ads, to, you know, high-end technical problem solving, we see open innovation be a problem.
Would it be accurate to say that open innovation paradigm has, you know, at its heart, a respect for intellectual diversity, which...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the core. Again, if you have to go back to Joy's Law, no matter who you are, most of the smartest people work with someone else, tells you that you want diversity. You want to be open to lots of people giving you different, very different perspectives. And then you have to figure out which ones are most valuable in the context you're going after. But searching broad, searching wide, searching deep is the essence of open innovation, and diversity is at the heart of it.
So if we measure human progress in this case by our ability to improve our quality of life, it would seem, again, that the essential objectives of open innovation, first to, as you mentioned, first to generate a wealth of ideas and then identify the best ideas, would also be really beneficial to developing good solutions. To address social and administrative issues. Again, what would you say to the use of open innovation in social development or institutional governance?
It's really hard to change hierarchical institutions to adopt open innovation. Right? It's really hard. We've been doing it for a decade, at my lab, and we know it's super tough. Most of these things peter out because, most of the organizational attempts at this require a ton of work by the change agents and the leadership to embrace this approach. And so it's, it makes a lot of sense in theory. It makes a lot of sense in practice, but putting it into existing organizational structures, in existing institutional structures, and having them both first prototype an experiment, then, pilot, right? Then scale. Those are long, long journeys. Like within my work at NASA, right? We've been at it for a decade, and we're just at the very, we haven't even penetrated the atmosphere, if I want to sort of use an astronomical thing. Like, we're just skimming the atmosphere of NASA and that organization around. Like, we have amazing results, but institutional change, culture change, mindset change takes a long, long time. And often you need, my view is it's like it takes at least 30 years, to drive this guy. You need dedicated people who are willing to believe in the mission, but are willing to be flexible and be open to the fact that there'll be lots of failures along the way as they try to do this cultural change. And really, in the corporate world, what happens is that companies fail, right? They disappear, right? You think about Nokia not understanding the open platform model and losing out to Apple and to Android, right? Same thing happened to Motorola. Same thing happened to Sony Ericsson and so forth. So in the corporate world, these institutions, these companies fail and disappear. Exactly. We need to figure out a way to have the institutions adapt and adopt and find ways to bring this into their processes. But that for me is like a super long journey.
So as a professor at Harvard, you teach, mentor, and shape some of the brightest youths in the world. What advice would you give?
I mean, all I would say is what has helped me personally has been to be curious, to follow my curiosity, and to really understand the puzzles in the world, to have great mentors, to be a good mentee and have great mentors, and then to not be afraid of work and to work hard. I was never the smartest person in my class. I was never the brightest light bulb at MIT or anywhere else I went to. But I had curiosity, I had great mentors, and I had hard work, and that's got me to where I am today. And so what I would say is that's the desire to excel, the desire to succeed has to come from within, and then you have to harness it in these ways.
Well, thank you so much for the interview.
Sure, you're welcome.
Thank you for listening to today's episode with Candidate Insights. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe or follow us on social media for updates on future episodes. If you've already subscribed, please leave us a rating or review. It does help new people find the podcast. I'm Sahil Badruddin, your host, and for a transcript of this interview and others, visit my website at sahilbadruddin.com.